not to say that any of the new twists and turns you've thought of wouldn't be successful. But the reality is that you have to start somewhere and execute that idea before adding in all the bells and whistles. Resources, especially your own capacity, are finite, and you need to be absolutely ruthless about what you will allow to use up your precious time, money, and energy. Austerity is also about knowing when to say no to losing focus. The answer is to call on the Yoga Sutras and limit your opportunitis with tapas. By getting comfortable with austerities as a necessary part of your good hustle practice, you gain a simple way to keep on track. By relating everything you do to what you're trying to achieve, decisions are unambiguous. It's a strategy deployed by everyone from entrepreneurs to athletes to get where they need to go, as suddenly everything that doesn't serve them falls away. Buddhist teacher Lama Zopa Rinpoche says that every morning, the first thought of the day should be setting an intention that all activities undertaken should work solely towards the liberation of all sentient beings from suffering. Any action can be decided by that simple tenet alone. Aside from being a pretty good way to start the day, this question, or something like it, can supplement your good hustle decision-making template. Does the action move you further towards your goal, and does it equally give opportunities to serve others with unconditional love? When these are the underpinnings, it's hard to see how austerities can possibly be a bad thing. When it comes to expenses, the same strategy can be applied. Will the purchase essentially contribute to your next goal in getting to live in your Dharma? If no, then it's a clear and simple decision that can be made without any compromise or heeding of your needy inner voice. Svadhyaya. The penultimate niyama is svadhyaya, or the study of the self. As with the previous niyamas, this can be both a literal and metaphoric experience. To really understand the complexities of the mind, time has to be spent interrogating thoughts and sitting with the processes that go on unchecked within us. Here's the thing. Everything in our mental consciousness is a conceptual story, our own opinion. Everything. And what's worse, our consciousness is a liar. Neuroses are eye-based, based on layers of lies. You know this junk. It's what we've been talking about for chapters. Keep reminding yourself that none of it is true. It's just opinion that flows down the river of your thoughts. Svadhyaya takes us on a trip down that river. Paddling along with intent, able to veer down a tributary if necessary, cataloguing all of the varieties of plants, animals and litter we find below and alongside our mind canoes. Unsurprisingly, meditation is the vehicle that allows this to unfold. And as the preceding niyamas are undertaken, the way is cleared for practice to get deeper, for insights to occur, and for revelations to lead to further renunciation. All of the niyamas build resilience and awakening to the true nature of self. Our attachments, our conditioning, and entanglement with the desire for permanence means that it takes space and time to get to the point where real self-study can occur. Much of the work in Socha is demolishing the mess of our minds, cleaning up the illusions, and leaving the good bones of our mental structure to work with. As we become more familiar with what and who we are, and more interconnected with our compassionate relationship with others, the ability comes to sit less in the ego I and more in the greater community of humanity. We are the observer, not the doer in our thoughts. The capacity to take the role of observer is important in self-study, as we have to be able to observe our behavior in an impartial way. This can, at the outset of our meditation practice, be like an ongoing dialogue with ourselves as we document the goings-on of our mind. There I am craving chocolate. There I am judging another. There I am judging myself. There I am full of pride of doing meditation. There I am believing I'm a better, worse person. There I am making up stories about my life. There I am believing my lying consciousness. And on it goes. By noting and dismissing these thoughts, we see the patterns and subtly redirect, calling ourselves out on our habitual critic in the process. In doing so, we are building new ways of thinking, where we strongly acknowledge that the old pattern of thinking isn't serving us. After a period of time, we begin to auto-correct even as the thought starts to form, self-censoring the behavior that pushes us back into a fear-based egoic loop of clinging and criticism. Once this new voice becomes established, the real progress of fighting against the ideas and emotional patterns that keep us fettered begins in earnest. I see this as distinctly different from a practice of relentless positivity and affirmation, where perceived negativity isn't countenanced for fear that it will somehow stain the rainbow. By observing all our thoughts without apportioning them as good or bad, our totality is the subject of self-study. There is no annex of fear, self-hate and negativity being pushed back by positivity until it spectacularly breaks out at the most inconvenient time. And this is where we can really know ourselves, our whole selves. We aren't being self-critical or self-loathing. We are just integrating and acknowledging who we are while building the mind towards who we want to be. No part of us is left behind. There is no shadow self, as all of us is available and welcome. At the same time as we conduct our self-study, we can study texts and consult teachers that are going to grow our wisdom. This is the duality of Svadhyaya, where the self-study is both internal and a process of wisdom acquisition. Accessing along the way teachers who help you reach your goals is an important part of your growth. Reading this book and texts like it is an element of that. In many Eastern belief systems, it is understood that we are born with our own divine wisdom fully installed. It is the samsara experience through living in the world that confuses and distracts us from the ultimate work of living in our Dharma. You could say we are finding our way back to us with reminders along the way, like a treasure hunt where the clues are too quiet to hear over the noise of our sense pleasures. Our teachers on the path to self-study appear in many guises and often unpredictably. Most of us will have had a teacher at school who somehow cut through and saw who we were. They lit a spark in us of self-belief that helped to wipe away a little of the dirt obscuring our view. Some of our teachers in life are painful and difficult to hold in our memories with compassion and grace, but we must. These teachers appear all through our lives, and the closer attention we pay to our Svadhyaya, the more we are able to listen to the teachings. Don't be tempted to see hardship and pain as roadblocks. See them as some ripened karma that, once cleared, will deliver great virtue. Resist the temptation to run to a safe, comfortable spot. Combat the rising aversion with patience and fortitude, knowing it will pass. In the West, we have been undoubtedly jaded in the way we view spiritual teachers or gurus, many of whom have been presented to us as exotic figures from the East. We often follow with little discrimination, only to later find they are revealed as charlatans or fakes, or more accurately, people just like us. The guru in many spiritual traditions plays the role of a teacher and leader. They take us with confidence and rigor into our next levels of discovery, especially in unraveling complex spiritual texts like the ones we are working with here. It's only because of the many, many interpretations and commentaries available to us that we are able to understand what those enlightened sages were trying to tell us all those centuries ago. One person's guru is another's charlatan, however, which is why it is important to read, follow, listen to, challenge, criticize, and observe the teachers and their teachings that resonate most with you. They are awakening in you your own wisdom. My advice in matters of self-study and the pursuit of knowledge is to cast your net wide. Go down a lot of unmarked streets and constantly be vigilant about what your mind is telling you. If a book jumps off a shelf at you, read it, even if the author is someone you never would have considered to be speaking your language. Where opportunities present, say yes, and with an open but critical mind, listen and learn. You will undoubtedly hit the pay dirt of resonation at the end of a meandering ramble that you didn't think was leading anywhere special or spiritual. Especially when on that nervous, excited cusp of starting something new, the temptation is to wallow in endless learning. Women are repeat offenders in believing that they need more and more knowledge to be able to successfully execute a business idea. You have to look out for the point at which the quest for knowledge becomes a safe haven for doing nothing and avoiding wisdom. No book or teacher is ever going to be able to teach you precisely how to do what it is that you are trying to achieve. Until you have actually gone out and begun yourself, you will not be actualizing your learning, merely stockpiling. When all the books are read, podcasts are listened to, blogs are scanned, and tweets and posts consumed, there is a point at which you have to rely on your own wisdom and begin. You'll be surprised at how authoritative you actually are and how empowering it is to get started and make some decisions. As long as you're open to things not always being as you imagined, before long, you'll realize you are capably doing business. Even if you are still feeling the remnants of thinking you are merely an actor playing a role, these are only the opinions of your mind. That you are doing it is living proof of your competency. The process of self-study continues in parallel with life. It, too, is a practice and needs to be a diligent one as you integrate your work and what it teaches you with your own Svadhyaya. Ishvara Pranidhan. At the end of it all is Ishvara Pranidhan, surrender to the divine. This whole process has been a continuum leading to your own preparedness to meet that part of you or your belief system that offers you unconditional love, entirely reliant on nothing but you. There is a common belief that enlightenment once reached is like a void or a blank of space and silence, that the enlightened disappear into another realm, leaving nothing behind. Lama Zopa Rinpoche argues that it is the opposite. It is exactly like life is right now, with a sense of unshakable, inconceivable equanimity, of blissful interconnectedness. The purpose behind the search for enlightenment isn't to remove yourself from the world you have spent so long and worked so hard to integrate into. It is to be fully alive and awake to the miracle of you and us and everything in the world. As you work towards finding your way to that place, the restraints and observances of the yamas and niyamas are there to guide, prepare, and upskill you to reach the divinity within. I don't believe that liberation or enlightenment is a moment of excessive fanfare and fireworks. I believe it is found in the absence of creating suffering, in the moment when you haven't reacted to a situation of immense stress, where you have felt limitless love and compassion for those who do you both good and ill, where your action and your heart meet and merge. I think we are given glimpses of Ishvara Pranidhan, tastes that nourish and encourage us to keep going until those morsels add up to a greater and greater amount of time where your mind is content. Attachment is replaced by the genuine desire for all beings to be happy and free. At this point, you bring that essence to whatever business or project you are undertaking. Then everything that you turn your hands, mind, and heart to delivers Dharma. It's not in the doing after all, it's in the being. You will naturally embody this state. In your work you will model this and inspire others to have what you're having. This will draw you to the community that supports you and values the way you want to live your life. You will be doing what you love because you will love everything. In your good hustle, Ishvara Pranidhan is best described as the point at which you find the thing you know, without doubt, is your Dharma. It is where your yearning for your true nature of self and the clear vision of what it is you are capable of doing is clearly revealed. Business on the path to enlightenment. The yamas and niyamas as two laundry lists of activities are themselves a fair undertaking, but both are essential in progressing along the path of becoming a contemporary good hustling yogi, of being able to create heart-centered businesses that are ripe with meaning and resilient. The heavy lifting is done at the front end, with constant ongoing maintenance required to ensure that the evolution in your way of being continues. It can feel like the yamas and niyamas alone are sufficient for Patanjali to have stopped there. It is a lifelong process. So too is the developing of a new business idea. It is this work of creativity, ideation, untrammeled thinking and unlimited wonder that takes you through all of the potentials and allows you to narrow them down through a process of logical and intuitive elimination. The destination is the place where you don't want to look for anything else. It has to be something that is big enough to make a difference, but small enough to be able to manage to bring it to life. It must contain the elements of compassion and love that make it the project that will allow you to feel like you have arrived in your life as an active participant, not a dupe hanging on the strings of someone else's responsibility. Number 3. Asana. Now the twin peaks of Yamas and Niyamas are climbed, we turn to the next arm of Patanjali's eight limbs. Asanas are the postures practiced in yoga, the physical activity that the majority of people in the West recognize as yoga. Asana needs to be put in the context of where yoga came from and what it was designed to do, to help you understand where it fits in your good hustle. In India, asana was a practice to gain flexibility and strength to prepare the body for long hours of sitting in meditation. Yoga was principally undertaken by men. This is in strong contrast to how it's been adopted in the West, where around 80% of participants are women. The postures were designed by men, for men's bodies, muscles and strength, and were practiced from early childhood. When yoga was brought to the West, it was recognized by the early Indian teachers that our culture had no established programs of meditation or mind control. The Ashtanga system, with its focus on stillness, breathing and meditation, was recognized as being initially very difficult for Westerners to grasp with our untrained minds. In a highly physical culture, the asana aspect was the obvious one to teach, and so it became the symbol of yoga. Many Western practitioners saw the benefits of the asana practice and continued to pursue the wisdom of yoga through its other limbs. The perceived cultural barriers of the sutras, however, mean that yoga as a physical practice dominates, along with the secular hybridized versions that have evolved in gyms and elsewhere. Most of us in the West would have met yoga through the postures and probably had many teachers who never made the biggest spiritual connection with the other parts of the sutras in which the asanas are found. While I have concentrated so far on hammering home the benefits of the mind and managing its unruly ways, the body as the sensory home of the mind is an essential element in your practice and good hustle. Much like there is a tendency to see yoga as an asana practice, there's also a strong tendency in Western cultures to view the body as who we are and strongly identify the physical as the real self. This makes a lot of sense in a culture where we are not steeped in a tradition of reincarnation that views the body as merely a convenient vehicle for this turnaround in our human incarnation. Understanding the body as a solid and permanent feature of our identities strongly roots our attachment to the physical and aesthetic aspects of who we are as essential and unchanging. You can see in relation to attachment and consequent suffering where the problems begin using this mindset. Our bodies become our business cards, judgment, criticism, and a relentless, punishing life of trying to conform ensue. At each interaction with other bodies, we compare and contrast, continually holding ourselves separate from everyone else. We identify in our differences and in our lack. Our approach to our bodies and their differences is particularly human in our classifications and judgments. We would never walk into a forest and look across the trees and say, "That one is too tall, that one too short, that one has too much bark and not enough leaves up top." We simply accept and delight in the vast diversity that nature offers in all her plants and beings. Your body is a similar offering. It is your instrument of movement, mind and action, nothing more. You need to keep it in the shape and form it needs to work properly over a lifetime, without overindulgence or abandonment, just regular scheduled maintenance. And you need to love each of the other bodies as you walk through the forest of our worlds. Asana has a valuable place in our yogic and good hustle practice and can definitely be the salve that begins to soften and heal our approach to ourselves. As a tool for healing and therapy, the benefits of a yoga practice have been proven comprehensively. Interestingly, one of the reasons asana works in the process of healing both physically and emotionally is that it gets us out of our heads and into a physical practice. The concentration required to harmonize the breath and the body, in theory, leave little room for distractions by the mind. This is yet another method of neural pathway rebuilding. By integrating the body and the breath in a practice that leaves participants feeling a sense of peace and union, the body can take on the role of healer and nurturer. BKS Iyengar says, "Health begins with firmness in the body, deepens to emotional stability, then leads to intellectual clarity, wisdom, and finally, the unveiling of the soul." The daily asana session on the mat has a lot to offer us as entrepreneurs, especially in the early stages. The practice of asana is essential for us to be strong and flexible. In the spirit of a life devoted to and in service for others, the desire to remain fit and healthy is not about wanting to live forever for the sake of youth and beauty. It is instead entirely about utilizing the longevity of our bodily vehicles to help us serve and gather enough integrated experiential wisdom to do so. We are watching in real time the inhabitants of the Western world being felled by chronic diseases. These epidemics are driven through lifestyles of overattachment to sense objects, a lack of movement, and a lack of preparation for our bodies to get as old as they are now able to do in the modern world. Yoga asana builds strength and flexibility to counter the aging of our muscles and tendons. This alone is a worthy reason for everyone to adopt a daily practice, even just as training to be able to bend over and pick up their socks off the floor in their 80s. Time spent on the mat is not peripheral to our minds. As our bodies work through the combinations of muscle stretching and breath work, we are engaged in a quest for the integration of our most precious tools. Through yoga asana practice, especially in the early years when our bodies are not the graceful origami of veteran yogis and are more like piles of pickup sticks wobbling around, yoga challenges our perceived barriers. As I've mentioned before, we are so limited in what we believe is possible. Without experience, we are bound to only conceive what we know, and the rest seems as distant and intangible as clouds. When we see certain postures in yoga, or attempt them, we are certain that we will never be able to attain the shape our body is required to get into. Until one day, we realize that our muscles are longer, our balance solid, our reach further, and we are suddenly there at the place that once seemed impossible. A new frontier is formed and a new horizon appears. Then our questing continues to the next distant posture. Asana is the physical expression of how we master ourselves. Our mind is kind of slippery. We think we have it, then realize that our hands are empty and it is again out of our grasp. It is a daily challenge that, unlike climbing Mount Everest, we can do with minimal risk, minimal resources, and maximum benefit. Much like the realizations that result from the niyama practices of austerity, asana proves that over time we can do the things we believed were impossible. Conquering these limiting self-beliefs is fundamental to being able to bring your good hustle from being a faraway idea to reality. When you take the time every day to grow yourself, you are giving yourself physical strength and discipline, both of which are needed to go the distance in your transition from life as a sensed pleasure slave chained to the bars of desire to a detached and happy being at one with everything. Sequencing of asana postures requires us to move our bodies and minds from place to place without clinging to a posture we might like because it feels good. Each asana is impermanent. In yoga asana, we are subtly changing our minds to accept the expansion of our bodies. So too, are we inculcating agility and acceptance of the continual rapid change in our lives, some of which we have control over, some of which we don't. Agility is the key to survival in those first tentative steps into your good hustle venture, whether working in your own startup or as an intrapreneur for another enterprise. There will be many conditions that determine in the moment how you respond to an asana. You might be feeling stiff or tired or a little twingy, or not quite warmed up. All of those factors will determine how you enter and exit a pose. How your mind is chattering away will also determine whether you feel long and strong or weak and unwilling, changing the shape of the expression of your asana. As you enter the market with your big, purposeful dream made real, subtle micro and macro determinants will change the way each day and each goal plays out. Your customers will ask for certain things. Your suppliers may change an order or a delivery or suddenly cease to exist. You might find one product sells where another is ignored or rejected by your customers. You might just find your server goes down on the day you had your big webinar scheduled, or a virus wipes out your database. You get the picture. None of these things are ultimately good or bad. They are simply what is and what needs to be dealt with to move your day, your business, and your project along. They will all take you to a new frontier, and some of them will seem like a gift. Others make you want to run for the doona and settle in. What asana practice will translate from the mat to the laptop or shopfront is that all of these situations will flow. and your reaction to them will change from day to day. How you feel about the ever-changing moment is irrelevant. Your reaction determines whether or not you get the job done efficiently. How you feel about one posture or another is similarly irrelevant. You have to move your body into the pose and out of it, no matter how you feel about it. How you feel about your body is similarly irrelevant. Tall or short, fat or slim, freckled or wrinkly. It is what it is today, and tomorrow it'll be subtly different. Overwhelmingly, however, a yoga asana practice is essential for keeping the vehicle of your body on the road that ultimately leads to the experience of the divine. Number 4, pranayama. This fourth stage of the Ashtanga process consists of techniques designed to gain control over breathing while recognizing the connection between the breath, the mind, and the emotions. Pranayama translates as life force expansion, and yogis believe, with a credible body of evidence, that it not only rejuvenates the body, but extends life. Prana is life force and energy, often achieved through breathing practices. A yama is a stretching, a regulation, a control. Thus, pranayama is an expansion of our life force and a stretching of our capacity through breath control. Not a stretch to see why it is such an integral and important part of a yoga practice. Pranayama in an asana routine can be undertaken at the commencement and conclusion of a yoga practice, as well as within the postures, or used as a standalone breathing practice at any time. The first four stages of Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga concentrate on understanding our personalities, gaining skill in controlling the body, and developing an awareness of ourselves. The body, while not separate from the mind, is a gross tool of the sense organs and a significant distraction from the journey towards a higher state of consciousness if not under strict control. Patanjali noted that the breath is a vehicle for achieving an awareness of our consciousness. We need to learn to slowly and systematically measure and manipulate its distribution. Understanding the vital role breath plays in stilling the mind and the body, it is also important to remember that breath is not under our control. In this light, we can look at our relationship with it in terms of pranayama as one of collaboration and negotiation, also key skills to master for our good hustle practice. Breath will come in and out. The amount of actual attention you've paid to breathing since your birth is minuscule. Breath doesn't need you as the doer, and this in itself is invaluable wisdom to remember. All of the time your mind has spent applying itself to planning control of and attachment to the things that you believe are most essential to your survival, reputation, good Instagram selfies, consuming rainbow layer cakes, is time you haven't spent on your breath. All the drama, the days when life seemed like it was literally going to end because of some heartbreak, criticism, disappointment, or disaster. You just kept on breathing and living. Breath as the most critical element to your life is seemingly a free agent, blissfully decoupled from your mind and its distractions, able to single-pointedly get on with delivering essential services day and night. There is much we can learn from our breath. And perhaps the best lesson is humility. Our mind needs to be reminded that it can pretend to be the boss all it likes, but everything we actually need is within, patiently performing and waiting to be noticed. If you are a yoga teacher or student, you will have heard this phrase many times, come back to the breath. The breath is the constant that we orient our practice around. It is the central golden cord of releasing distraction and returning to stillness and awareness. Breath similarly anchors meditation practices. We follow its path in and out of our nostrils with wonder each time we return, as if seeing the miracle of our breathing for the first time. The gratitude and eager embrace of breath as something to anchor us to settle our minds is soon lost again as the rain clouds of thought return and the process of loss and gaining of consciousness continues. When we talk about training our breath in yoga, we are really training our bodies to recognize that breath is there and available to us. We can slow it down, deepen it, extract healing powers from it, and regulate the reaction of our body and minds. The breath within those actions doesn't fundamentally change. we change around it. Pranayama teaches us the fundamental requirement as entrepreneurs to trust and surrender to that we don't control. These layer together when we make breath a conscious and central part of our practice in a loop of remembrance and surrender. It is the physical and lived experience of that wisdom. What we need to grasp is that despite what happens around it, breath just keeps going. It's not attached to anything. This is how we need to model ourselves as we move down the path of ideation into the setup of our new businesses. We need to keep moving in a regular rhythm, paying attention without attachment, and making decisions based on simply moving the concept forward, breath by breath. If pranayama is the extension of our vital life force energy through breathing practice, and we are summoning this life force to help us with the monumental task required to shift our mindsets, it stands to reason that we are going to need to harness and cultivate quantities of energy. We need to generate prana, and we need to consciously work with our asana and pranayama practice to do so. As we increase strength, fortitude, and resilience in the body, so too the breath as the vehicle of our consciousness and awareness needs to be cultivated. If you aren't a current practitioner of pranayama, start today. Start right now. Just sit. Book or Kindle in hand or headphones on and focus on the breath. Connect to the idea that nothing happens without it, and it happens with nothing originating from your conscious thinking mind. Simply deepening the quality of your inhalations is going to be a boon for your health. You can start with a couple of minutes a day, include it in your yoga asana practice or on waking and retiring, but the key part is to make it a conscious practice and link that neural pathway to unlocking your own inner intelligence. Pranayama is not just breathing. Be mindful of the subtle difference. It is the harnessing and stoking of energy, building the furnace to fuel your inner workings to new heights. What else might be sitting silently inside you, working on autopilot, waiting for a chance to be uncovered as you quieten the mind? This is an actual process rather than an intellectual one. It starts with using pranayama as a tool to calm the mind, still our bodies, and energize ourselves. It may feel a little strange at first, as though you are having a conversation with yourself, but persist. The shift will come when you trust yourself and realize that you have the answers if you choose to listen. These days, I am a great consulter of my inner wisdom, or however you want to characterize this innate voice. I quiet down and engage my breath and focus my mind on my interior world, which will of course look, feel, and be perceived differently for everyone. When I first started this practice of inner consultation, I'd ask myself a question and an answer would snap back at me. I was convinced I was just talking to myself. After all, that voice sounded the same as the one that was the critical inner monologue that had been my life companion. I came to realize that while the voice sounded the same, it was definitely not me. It was the quality of the response that was different. There wasn't a sense of outcomes being good or bad. There was simply advice being given. I didn't have to be anything or anyone different. I was being given the advice unconditionally, without prejudice. I could choose to use or ignore it, and I knew that the outcome would be furthering me, whatever I chose. But I also knew that I got an honest answer, so much so that now, if I suspect I won't like what I'm going to hear, I might delay the asking. This inner wisdom is not something special to me. It's not something you have to take a course on or do 10 different levels of initiation at escalating costs to enjoy, despite what you may see advertised. Every one of us has access all the time, but we need to prepare the ground to hear. With your inner voice, just ask the question that you want answers to in a simple and straightforward way and wait for the answer. As I said, it might take you a little while to learn how to recognize your own divinity at work, but persevere. As you develop ideas for your good hustle endeavors, link the practice of pranayama to sessions where you are working on ideation and creativity. As you would engage your core to sustain a yoga pose, engage your breath to sustain your mental acuity. When you hit a big decision or a stressful moment, engage your breath to bring everything back to an even keel. Take the energy that might be stuck in your chest or throat and redistribute it around your whole body and return your sympathetic nervous system to its regular program. While the breath doesn't need your control, you can certainly collaborate with it when your body gets out of kilter through external stresses and shocks. When your concentration is lacking through tiredness, those new austerity measures of getting up early can take some adjustment. You can binge on pranayama, not chocolate, to re-energize your afternoon or evening and continue getting the work done for your good hustle project. Our breath is a potent teacher of many lessons and a constant force to be used on our journey inwards. Pranayama is a critically important practice and one that deserves attention and integration into our daily lives. Number 5. Pratyahara. Pratyahara is the continuation of turning inwards and starting to address the world outside of our constant sensory stimulus. This stage is always represented to me in the part of every yoga class where vigorous action slows, eyes are closed, and you are taken out of your physical exertions and into the gentle passage to Savasana. It is no accident that even within the structure of a yoga class, we are replicating a microcosm of the yamas and niyamas in every posture and breath. The practice of pratyahara provides us with an opportunity to step back into the role of observer or witness, to impartially and compassionately look at ourselves and really see who we are. In doing so, we can take the opportunity to catalogue the parts of ourselves that serve us and the parts that don't, without contributing to our own suffering with self-criticism and harsh words. Silence, stillness and contemplation are not a big part of Western culture. We like noise and distractions. Consequently, our minds have become the equivalent of having the TV blaring on a shopping channel 24/7. We are so attached to external stimulus, to things and what we see as the permanent tangibles of life that define our experience of being, that the idea of turning in, or away from the outside, is one that is often hard to grasp. Like letting go, it's a phrase that is maddeningly free of detailed instructions. The sense is that we can simply release and move on, but as everyone knows, this is far easier said than done. The work of pratyahara doesn't mean that you can't be working on your good hustle plan at the same time. All this can be travelling in parallel, but the awakening of the Dharma is the priority at the outset. The only way to get there is to turn in and deal with what has been stopping you. Pratyahara is the limb where you are really committing to do the deep work, armed with the emerging dialogue of your own innate wisdom. This is the practice that leads to your divinity and your Dharma. The sirens of your attachments continue to call throughout each limb. This is the fundamental nature of distraction. So how, why, and when do we turn in? Pranayama, our breathing practice, is the precursor to pratyahara, both in the sequence of the eight limbs and in the action of turning focus to the breath. We bring the prana inside to build consciousness and energize our entire bodies. It is here we are already renouncing the outside world for the inky mystery of our internal realms. The breath straddles the cusp of our extroverted body and our introverted inner world. This is where we find the mind, and the process of pratyahara takes us from a place of looking and seeing in our externally focused view to listening to our inner voice, our inner wisdoms. On the inside, the ego seems to have fewer places to grip. Without the familiar visual cues of the body and world to give us place and context, turning in gives us little to grasp, decoupling our familiar dualities and creating space for new ways of thinking and being. This is how we can work on change in ourselves. Switching down the lights and gently pushing ourselves into finding new ways of getting around, wearing new tracks in our minds. Once the disorientation of being effectively blindfolded against our primary senses occurs, there begins the sensation of freedom and potential, where our awareness is released into infinite space. This is the moment in meditation that I am most attached to, when I leave the wriggling and adjusting and mental cataloguing and have the first sensation of emptiness and dropping down within. For those tiny moments, it feels like free fall as the outer world is nullified and time takes on a new dimension. It is developing the discipline of asana and moving to a breathing practice that prepares us for the new senses and sensations of pratyahara. With our external senses, we engage in an acquisition process. We see things, we judge them, we identify them, we relate them to us, and attach labels like good or bad, want or don't want, all the usual dualities that keep us busy, separate and miserable. Pratyahara takes that sense shopping away, and rather than the public cavalcade of desire, offers us up our internal catalogue, which is infinitely less desirable. The discipline is to stay focused, stay present, simply observing as the raw and uncensored explosion of your mind pours forth. Yes, it is a visceral and often confronting experience. My attachment to the opening moments of entering the space of internal contemplation is no doubt a response to the battle that is quick to follow of taming and controlling my thoughts. Without all of the sense pleasures to keep me distracted, in pratyahara I'm confronted by the spectre of my mental torments and temptations. If I want to focus on the breath, I can be sure that my mind wants me to focus on the itching on my face, the pins and needles in my foot, the delicious meal I yearn for, a deeply shameful thought I had relegated to the back of my mind, the piercing hurt of betrayal or rejection that brings instant pain to my being. These are the mind battles that I and so many people experience every time we sit down and turn within. It's no wonder that despite the known benefits of meditation, many of us choose not to run this gauntlet in the practice of taming our unruly minds. The antidote to the cacophony of internal chatter in silent meditation is what amounts to a process of tag and release. Non-attachment lies here. It is where the practice of letting go and detaching from emotion and reaction begins. A thought arises. We note it, superficially examine its root cause in relation to previous thoughts, and then release it. Whatever it is, tag and release. Don't hold on, deep dive, reiterate and resolve. Simply note that a thought has come, you recognize it, and now it can go. With practice in the practice, there is a pattern to what appears regularly in our thoughts, and with familiarity, the process becomes quicker. The temptation to explore, to follow our thoughts down the rabbit holes of our mind, and to indulge the fictional narratives that accompany our version of life is a constant struggle. The torment and busyness definitely lessens as we train ourselves to keep dismissing and coming back. But there is often a sense of things getting worse, and a feeling that you will never get past the whirling dervishes of your mind. You will. When and where in our good hustle practice do we engage the process of pratyahara? The limb of pranayama reminded us of the truth about our control over essential services, or not. We sought inner wisdom through the non-conscious nature of breathing. As we release the doing, in pratyahara, we dive into the being. Here we see the mud being stirred up by our minds as we endeavour to settle and eventually see clarity in the water of our thoughts. By withdrawing the senses and seriously attending to managing your mind, you are polishing the diamond of yourself. In this action, you are enabling the inner vision of who you are and what is most going to serve you. For all the marketing hype around the idea of doing what you love, meaning never working a day in your life, this needs to be balanced with the reality of the internal work that has to be done every day. It doesn't mean you won't love doing it. It's an essential part of the path to your own growth and freedom from suffering. But this is, as frequently reiterated, a lifetime commitment, with much of it spent in an inward-facing position. Pratyahara teaches us the skills of tagging and releasing our thoughts without attachment. While this is applied to our inner work, it can also be applied to our outer work. The distractions that call us away from the mundane but necessary tasks of planning and researching our new ventures, budgeting, strategizing, and doing the things we find hard and distasteful, are a constant in life. We can translate the discipline from our practice of pratyahara, of acknowledging the call to turn our attention elsewhere, and the route that drives it, and return to our work, knowing that our concentration is required. Number 6. Dharana. Each stage of the eight limbs can be plucked out and used individually, but collectively they lead to union in lockstep. The practice of pratyahara creates the setting for dharana, or concentration. Having removed outside distractions by withdrawing the senses, we can continue to deal with the far more intrusive and overwhelming distractions of the mind itself. In the practice of dharana, we learn to slow down the thinking process by concentrating, using the role of the observer. Dismissing thoughts after we have tagged and released them is the first part of the procedure to still our minds. This isn't so much concentration, although it does require a sustained effort. Once the chatter, clatter, snapping and sniping is managed, the concentration part of meditation can test the efficacy of our new mind muscles to hold the errant thoughts at bay. This can be done using classic techniques of meditation, where the puppy or monkey mind is tethered to the post of a single mental object. Sometimes a tethered puppy will sit quietly, awaiting its owner's return or command. Other times, it will pull and squirm and whine until acknowledged and given its way. The tethering of the puppy mind is a similarly unpredictable excursion. Find a tether point that is somewhat comfortable or compelling for you to visualize, that you can commit your time to. This can be anything you can imagine, but commonly people choose a specific place in the body, such as the third eye or above the navel or a chakra. It can be an image of a deity or guru, a candle flame, the entry and exit point of the breath, or silent repetition of a sound, such as Om or Ram. Initially, the introduction of a point of concentration is in itself a distraction, and for at least a couple of seconds, it seems possible to focus on a single point, without it being shredded and scattered to the four corners of the mind. All too swiftly, you realize that while you started out watching the flame, that quickly morphed into self-congratulation about your powers of meditation. From there, you snuck into a maze of mildly related concepts, and the flame of single-pointed concentration was well and truly snuffed out. Like the discipline of pratyahara, the only course is to come back to the flame or your point of tether over and over again. During this repetition, you begin to realize that the point of concentration is not in holding the image. It is in the shortness of time between realizing you have let go and coming back and starting over. There is a saying that dharana can't be taught, only caught. In knowing that, you can practice catching as well as concentrating. I mentioned earlier opportunitis as being one of the pitfalls of the ideation stage of creating your good hustle, where there are so many opportunities that you want to grab that you end up not being able to execute on any of them. I'm sure you've picked up right away the reason that the limb of dharana in yoga is necessary. Concentrating on one thing is a skill that is being systematically dismantled in our culture. When the term multitasking entered the lexicon, it became a desirable skill, one that indicated the capacity for hyper-productivity and superior juggling of priorities. It's a must-have on your CV, and is seen as particularly useful for women who are masterful at multitasking in their poly roles, managing the household, caring for aging parents, raising children and completing study. Maintaining a career is now seamlessly integrated with the other full-time work assumed. Our attention is trained to be on many things at once, and this has been compounded by the always-on state of our mobile devices. No longer do we simply watch TV. We also have conversations, eat dinner, engage on multiple social media channels, and respond to email simultaneously. We are taking in vast quantities of information and trying to process it all in some meaningful way. It's a little wonder that anxiety is so widespread. It is stressful and exhausting to maintain that level of engagement over many hours, days, and weeks. This gives us a clue as to why, when asked to let go and still the mind, it seems like a Herculean task. This is the backdrop against which we need to ask how Patanjali would have advised his contemporary yogis to reach for their nirvana. If our intention in knowing our minds is a search for the root cause of our suffering, this is an easy undertaking. Too much communication is the symptom, and an underlying anxiety of not being enough is the root of the pain. The simple solution is to reject the assertion that we need to be simultaneously connected and always available. Refuse to participate. Set your own agenda and boundaries for access that is acceptable to your pace and needs. It's that easy. Most of us haven't actually tested the hypothesis to see if the world ends when we don't have a device at our fingertips. In Buddhism, there's a set of precepts where one of the explicit undertakings is renouncing being human. It sounds overly dramatic and final, but the breakdown of the idea is that as humans, we are all hopelessly devoted to sense objects, or the eight worldly dharmas, which will be covered a little later. And because of that, we are from birth in a state of suffering. The recommendation from one of the enlightened beings of Buddhism is that to break with the root of samsara, we have to break with our humanness. For you and me, in our lives in transition to being good hustlers, it means that we are accepting that, gradually, as we get further into our spiritual practices and our search for self, the sense pleasures and material attachments that our fellow humans are oriented to are no longer our motivations. We don't want to go to the pub or gossip and snipe about others or binge on Netflix series or play Minecraft for 12 hours or fixate on food, booze, pills and their consumption. In making these choices, we remove our humanness as we remove our attachments to the primary causes of suffering. It is a big and interesting concept, which also loops us back to the heart of the idea of impermanence. If we aren't what we know to be the label of human, what and who are we? The answer is, it doesn't really matter, if what we are is compassionate and loving. Disciplining ourselves to undertake one single-pointed task at a time is another way of retraining that part of us that has forgotten what concentration feels like. I regularly experience this while I'm doing something like writing or trying to deliver a project to deadline. While deep in thought, suddenly, as if compelled by outside forces, I'll find myself reaching for my phone to look at email or social media. It's infuriating, as by the time I realize what's happening, I've lost my flow and have to then capture my concentration again and return to the sentence. Nothing needs me in any instant, but I need the comfort of my own distractions. You need to return to the nostalgic ways of concentration. We all do. I've noticed over the years that one of the constant traits of entrepreneurs is the capacity for an inherent, almost unconscious adoption of similar practices that are used in yogic disciplines. Entrepreneurs are able to see and hold a single point of focus, no matter what distractions and hardships come across their path. They may well flow around them, or be agile in their approach to achieving their goal, but even though the method may change, they are able to successfully hold their focus. Cultivating concentration in the pursuit of your good hustle doesn't have to be a practice just directed at turning off your devices to complete a piece of work. It is also a social and interactive action that can and should be used in interactions with each other. I like to consciously engage Dharana when talking to someone, giving them my single-pointed attention, rather than listening with one ear, checking texts, and thinking about my next meeting or some other problem. By maintaining a sensory focus on actively listening to and looking at them, taking in the full experience of being in the moment with that person, the richness of information gathered is exquisite and the exchange is loving and meaningful. Service to others sits here. It is a service to people when we truly connect and listen and give them our full attention, when we see and hear them in their completeness, and reflect back to them through our actions that they are worthy of our time and attention. This is an act of devotion. It can and should also be an act of unconditional love, as there need be no expectation of anything other than that moment of connection. In a brand and customer sense, bringing this individualized concentration to interactions is a display of pure authenticity. That buzzword that symbolizes the cut through which all businesses are looking for. It doesn't come from slick marketing and strategizing. In a service-oriented enterprise, it comes from genuinely realizing that customers don't simply exist for a transactional exchange to build your revenue. They exist as individuals and humans and are the sentient beings that your heart longs to integrate with. When we undergo the practice of creating a persona of our customer for marketing purposes, we are doing far more than homogenizing a template of our ideal target for sales. That is an entirely conditional viewpoint that only looks to what benefits you can get rather than what you can give. When working on understanding who your ideal customer is, undertake the exercise of creating a persona to design a clearly defined customer. This person is the one to whom you can offer the most service and deliver your promise of unconditional love and compassion. This is a significant part of the good hustle mindset. Number 7. Dhyana. Meditation or contemplation, the 7th stage of Ashtanga, is the uninterrupted flow of concentration. Although mindful concentration and meditation seem to be practically identical, there are infinite differences. Where dharana practices one-pointed attention, dhyana is the ultimate state of being acutely aware but renouncing focus. The mind has been quieted by the preceding activities and disciplines learned through the other limbs. In the stillness you have created, the production of thoughts is reduced to a minimum, theoretically at least. Dhyana is where all the practice has been leading. Learning the ability to slow it all down and look within enables the work on awareness and self to be integrated. We've covered much of the territory that leads us here as we work through Patanjali's recipe for becoming yogi. Now we are at the destination of dhyana. The practice itself is like a whole new beginning, bringing a new set of learnings. As one of the seminal texts on yoga as a system of living, the Bhagavad Gita is integral to good hustle practices. Krishna's advice in the Gita on meditation is a perfect companion to where we have landed. In the Gita, Krishna makes a passionate defense of the benefits of meditation. Our other protagonist, Arjuna, is in a state of emotional paralysis over starting the battle of Kurukshetra. He is slumped in the bottom of his chariot, weapons down, unable to motivate himself to get up and begin fighting. Arjuna, as a fierce warrior at this point, is displaying character traits more akin to those of a whiny child as he pouts and sulks in answer to Krishna's increasingly firm entreaties to bring some mindful action into the moment. This is a place all of us have been to. I encounter it regularly when the alarm goes off to get up for meditation or to go to a yoga class or to start a piece of work or edit a manuscript. It's a place where you just can't take the next step. You know you must. You know that when you do it, it will be good for you and you'll enjoy it. And yet there you are, slumped at the bottom of your own chariot, your mind filling you up with thoughts of all the other things you could do and all the reasons to stay exactly where you are. Krishna throughout the Gita comes back again and again to meditation as the foundation of any imminent action. The Gita works as a text for those of us about to embark on making their Dharma their life, as it is a reminder that while following the path is hard, it is far harder to do nothing and live a life empty of true purpose. Arjuna speaks for all of us when he counters Krishna's prescription for meditation by pointing out that meditation is hard, like controlling the mind to controlling the wind. And Krishna's response? Just keep practicing. Krishna is ardent about the practice of meditation as the key tool to reveal our true self and its nature. He gives Arjuna explicit instructions on what to do, how to sit, how to breathe, the stages to work through. He teaches him yoga for life right there on the edge of the battlefield. Krishna says that the practice of meditation is the solution to us getting back to our innate wisdom, the knowledge of who we are and what we are here to do. As long as we don't know who we are or what to do, we remain actors, playing out roles that only ever reach a peripheral layer of our being. Sometimes we get so good at playing the role we stepped into that we never take off the mask and get typecast, unable to ever struggle out of our costumes and be ourselves. It takes courage to step out of being human and commit to searching for who we are and a way to live in our truth. Arjuna's feeling of paralysis is a common condition when you come across that one business idea that you know is going to be your ticket to Dharma. There is an accompanying sensation of vastness mingled with sheer terror. This is what you see when the veil is removed, and for one clear moment you connect and are shown what life can be like. In the Gita, Arjuna asks Krishna to show him who he is, referring to his godly persona rather than his charioteer childhood buddy image. Throughout the story, Arjuna has only encountered Krishna in his human form, and while he knows he is possessed of godly powers, he wants the proof of Krishna's divinity. When Krishna obliges by revealing his immortal self, Reportedly, an endless array of Krishna's many bodies, forms, powers and actions all at once. Arjuna is completely overwhelmed. Krishna has blindsided him, and he struggles to recalibrate the idea of the Krishna he knows and the infinite source of wonder that he just saw, begging Krishna to immediately return to his original flavor. This is how we find ourselves paralyzed and overwhelmed when we